Sadducees, people who rejected the oral law, rejected the life after death, people who were in cahoots with Rome and were, if you will, very, very corrupt. The Sadducees entirely controlled and corrupted the temple. That's why indeed the Essenes had to run to the Dead Sea area. They didn't want to be and see the corruption that was taking place in Jerusalem. The final priest is cut off. What does cut off mean? Cut off means he's ruled. He's not the priest anymore. The priesthood is finished. The Elo, they translate it not for himself. It doesn't mean not for himself. The Elo means, and he'll have nothing. It's all over. The priesthood has been terminated. The people of the prince who comes will destroy the city and the sanctuary. This is fascinating. The people of the prince, of course, are the people of Titus, Vespasian, Rome. The armies of Rome come now to destroy it all. Daniel tells us that after this 62-week period, two things happen. Number one, this anointed one is cut off. Number two, the second temple is destroyed. Little problem. This can't possibly be speaking about Jesus, because there are 5.5 weeks between Jesus and the destruction of the second temple. They can't be together. Again, if Jesus is crucified somewhere around the year 30, we know the second temple was destroyed in about the year 70. That's 5.5 weeks of times 40 years between Jesus' crucifixion and the destruction of the second temple. But Daniel says, look, this is all happening after the 62 weeks. Not 62 weeks and 4.5 weeks. After 62 weeks, these are the two things that happen. Number one, the anointed one's cut off. Number two, the temple is destroyed. That his end shall come like a flood until the end of war. Desolation is decreed. Now, I explained earlier that indeed when bad things happen to the Jewish people, they happen slowly. When you have time to read Josephus, you'll see there is described that under Nero, emperor of Rome at that time, as towards the end, Nero went to literally entirely stop the sacrificial system even before 77 years before. And what happens is the great sages of the Jewish people plead to him to allow them to continue some elements of the sacrificial system. And he agrees and allows them to continue the sacrifices. The agreement, the covenant, is made between them. But, and those of you who are familiar with Jewish history know that about 3 years later, a little more than 3 years later, suddenly that covenant, the promise that he had made, that Jews could at least continue the sacrificial system, was terminated, and sacrifices were no longer able to be brought. Let's take a look at the next verse. And he will strengthen a covenant with the great ones 1 week. And for half the week, he will abolish the sacrifice and offering, and upon soaring heights will the mute abominations be, until extermination, as decreed, will pour down upon the abomination until they're destroyed. And that's, of course, until the end of days. We still have Edom. It's sitting in Rome today. You know, of course, the question is, what happened? If this is talking about Jesus, where are these six things? Why didn't they happen? Why don't we have everlasting righteousness? It didn't occur. The church, by the way, doesn't even know what to do with this last week. They have no idea. What do you do with the last week? If you're having Jesus killed at the end of 69 weeks, and how they time it, you know, you ask them, where do you start counting the 69 weeks? You can't start from Cyrus, so you got to start from Artaxerxes, you will hear. Oh yes, Artaxerxes, in 444 BCE, you will be told, you know, gave the order to Nehemiah that he can go and repair the wall that surrounded Jerusalem, hardly rebuilding Jerusalem, rebuilding the temple. And by the way, the word is not used there, it's an egeris, he's sending a note. It's not talking about Artaxerxes, and I am proud to say that many evangelical Christians agree. Some of the people that you've heard of, Calvin agrees and says this is clearly talking about Cyrus. And he says, if you read his commentary on Daniel 9, he says, don't ask me how to figure out the years. More recent evangelists like David L. Cooper from this century wrote a book called Messiah, His First Coming Scheduled. Famous book. And is it in it? He says, yeah, this is talking about Cyrus clearly. Now, I want you to know something. There's a very serious controversy here and you need to know about it. There's a serious controversy between the Jewish people and the secular world about chronology, and you need to understand this. We've had a number of arguments. Most of them have been settled already. They used to say there was no place called Ur Kasdim, where Abraham was born. They found it. They used to say there was no place, there was no wall around Jericho that fell suddenly without scorch marks. They found it. They used to say the oil that the Talmud says was used in the temple was the wrong kind of oil, because where did they get it from? And they found it. They found it. They found it. And there is still one more big controversy waiting, and that is the controversy of chronology of the Second Temple period. I think I should explain. According to secular chronology, when was the First Temple destroyed in what year? According to secular chronology, the First Temple was destroyed in the year 586 BCE. According to secular chronology, and this is the area that we agree on, when was the Second Temple destroyed? That creates a problem. Because if we say that the First Temple was destroyed in the year 586, okay, and that's when the First Temple was destroyed, and we know there was a 70-year Babylonian exile, there's a very big problem. That doesn't get us down to 70. If we get only 420 years for the Second Temple, and that's a very serious problem. There's about a 166-year controversy between the Jewish people. There are secular chronologists who agree with us, but the majority do not. There are Christian chronologists who agree with us, but the majority do not. And that is that the secular chronology has 166 years more. It actually winds up in the Persian period than the Jewish people. And this today is it's a controversy. And it's out there right now. And it's a very serious controversy. Now, of course, I'm waiting till this one is finally put to rest. It's something that I'm working on right now. Because imagine the problem. You see, we were there, they were, we lived through that time, we know how long that period was. Imagine what would be involved for whatever reason the sages had for hiding 166 years. Whatever motive they had, how do you do that? Remembering, the Jews weren't just living in the land of Israel during the Second Temple period. Oh no. Jews were in Babylon. The greatest Babylonian institutions were there. It would require a national conspiracy to erase 166 years. Imagine all the ketubahs written and so on, all these things. Suddenly, we have the date on there, it's all there. Suddenly, whoop, you know what we're going to do? Shh, don't tell anyone. 166 years under the table. How did you do that? Now that we have genealogies, we know our genealogies. You can take any Jewish genealogy that runs itself right through the Second Temple period and just add up the life and the time that their children were born and just add it up, and you'll see that it won't come out to more years. But this does remain a controversy. It's not only, for instance, David L. Cooper, in his book on page 385, actually says that the Jewish chronology is correct. Now, he's a Christian. He is certainly not interested in supporting the Jewish people. He actually then brings in the Jewish sources for the chronology. But indeed, the vast majority of the world, they are against us on this issue. And that's why I have used tonight the year from creation and not the year that you're familiar with, 75, 86, and so on, because that would have only created enormous confusion. And it is my prayer and hope that soon that final controversy will finally be put to rest. I hope you understand how important every letter and every word of the Bible is. Sometimes we read it, we pour through it. If someone would just take a look, as we see in Daniel 9, verse 2, the word of Hashem from the prophet Jeremiah, and then just see in the second prophecy of Jeremiah 29:10, the word, Devar, comes up again. And in Ezra chapter 1, Devar, Devar Jeremiah. If you're reading the Bible and you don't understand what you're reading, stop. Pray that God would open your heart and mind so that you understand His Word. Read it again. It's precious. It's holy. On behalf of Outreach Judaism, I want to thank all of you for being here tonight. Thank you. This is your favorite time of the evening, so I hear. Do you have any questions? If you have any questions, this is the time to ask them. Yes.
Well, I say yes. I understand. I learned the Torah and so on, but I'd like to go back to history. And I have a two-pronged question. Number one, during World War II, mostly of the churches in here and overseas were so violently bombed while our brothers and sisters went to the slaughterhouse. After the war, they were so anxious, mostly of, not all of them, but mostly of, so anxious to proselytize us to Christianity. And they all tell us, if you don't believe in Jesus, you can't go to heaven. for those who tell me that, I would rather stay here than go to heaven. I got time to go to heaven when I'm 120. My second question is, if you can answer it.
125 with inflation.
Okay. And then another thing of weight.
Let me deal with. Is that a question you're asking? Okay. So, all right. Let me do that, and then we'll do the second one. But it's important because the people will get a lot. And I think you didn't really form it as a question, so maybe I'll turn it as a question. I think what you're saying is you have a hard time understanding how can the church do what it's doing to the Jewish people now. I mean, and if anyone wants to read about the silence of the church, there's a wonderful book written by a Christian, the son of a pastor, The Abandonment of the Jews. It's a wonderful book to understand how the world fell silent. And it wasn't just that Pope Pius the 12th, oh, wonderful name, Pope Pius the 12th stood silently during as European Jewry went up in flames, even after the Holocaust. The next job of the church was even more interesting. They then took those Nazis and hid them, gave them false passports, and then sent them to South America and other places, just to make sure that they were safe after they had done their deed. Oh, the question becomes, don't you have a heart? Don't you have a soul? How could you now evangelize us the way you are? I want to answer you how a Christian would answer you. A Christian would say to you that withholding the gospel from a Jew is the greatest act of anti-Semitism. You need to know that. I'm talking about an honest, decent Christian. If you believe that by the only conduit to salvation is through the cross, right? And the way, the life, and the truth, there is no one comes to the Father except through the Son, John 14:6. If you believe that, well, then withholding the gospel of a Jew, if you take everything to its full logical conclusion, why withhold the gospel from the Jew? And I'll tell you, that's the evangelical fundamentalist response, but I want you to know that thankfully, liberal Christians don't feel that way. They don't feel that way at all, and a lot has changed. The world hasn't recovered from the Holocaust today. They have not. You know, I mean, think about it, if today the United Nations would vote if Israel should be a state or not, you know, if it would happen today. I mean, those couple of years after the Holocaust, there was a window open where indeed the world did feel enormous pain. And that's how you could have the world voting for Israel. Now, of course, God was moving their hand. But we still look at what was happening. Those things wouldn't happen today. You'll notice that in Christian scholarship, it has changed to the Jewishness of Christianity. And you'll see that both amongst Catholic and Protestant scholarship. Everyone's talking now about, we have to now re-examine, that's what's in now. If you want to talk about what's important, you want to re-examine the Jewishness of Jesus, and that's all that's being spoken about. You come out and say that, well, it's not talking about the Jewishness of Jesus, you looked at it like a fool. Everyone, Catholics and Protestants together are doing that. The Holocaust had a lot to do with that. In a sense, the people in it realized that something terrible had gone awry. So they were re-evaluating their own faith. It's a very, very great tragedy what is happening. And I think the important thing for us as Jewish people to do is to ask Christians, don't you want to understand the Bible from the very people who gave it to you? I mean, wouldn't it be silly for Americans who wouldn't understand the Declaration of Independence to go to the Chinese? I mean, why not go to the people who brought it to you? With an open mind, prayerfully. And it has to be done carefully, because understand that although much of the leadership unfortunately is corrupt, many of the people filling the pews in churches are sincere. They are. And they really feel they're saving the Jewish people. It's true that Christianity, by definition, requires you to accommodate certain concepts about the Jews that are not pleasant. The New Testament is not a document that says nice things about the Jews. It just isn't. Even the subtle stories, the Good Samaritan, I've talked about all this stuff, it's just not very pleasant about the Jews. The New Testament always seems to be walking the rope. That is that, in terms of knowledge and information, the Jews are right, but in terms of the Spirit, they have scales over their eyes, right? Like in Matthew 23, a really rather ugly chapter. It begins with Jesus saying, look, the scribes and Pharisees, they sit in Moses' seat. Now, if you're not sure what that means, Well, just go to the next verse. Therefore, whatever they tell you, listen. Do what they say, don't do as they do. But the information they're teaching is true. The Pharisees are teaching true godly information. And that's why in John chapter 4, we have the Samaritan woman who asks Jesus, now it's not a controversy, people don't even realize this, where is the real holy city? Is it Greece? Is it Jerusalem? And Jesus says, well, when it comes to information, the Jews have it right here. Don't. When it comes to information, real information, the Jews have it. Salvation is of the Jews. Unfortunately, that statement is misused. That's not the context. It's not talking about salvation of the Jews. It's talking about the information. The Jewish people are the people that are bringing the true oracles of God to the world. So it's interesting that there are many responses. Liberal Christians indeed say we should not, you know, evangelize the Jewish people. Evangelical Christians say, what a time to evangelize them. Matthew 23, verse 39. We have to evangelize them in order to bring about the final redemption, the kingdom of heaven. I will not return until you say, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. That has to be fulfilled. So it's a dichotomy. And we, the Jewish people, live here as a light to the nations. They hate us, but they love our Bible. It's interesting. You would think the prophets spoke about it. Isn't it bizarre? I mean, you know, it's, some people say, well, you know, maybe Jewish history is a fluke. We're an eternal nation. We're still here. It can happen. You can have a mutation. One nation just seems to out-survive it. But yet the same prophets who said that the Jews would be an eternal nation also said, you'd be hated amongst the nations where you would go. Wherever you go, you'd be a byword for persecution. You would be a metaphor. If you want to talk about a hated people, it would be the Jews. And yet they also said that while you're in exile, while you'll be amongst nations, you'll be hated. They will take their concept of God and throw it away and replace it with yours. You're going to be a light to the nations. Does that really make a whole lot of sense? Thinking back then, a prophet, wise people saying that you're going to be hated, but they're going to take your concepts of God and replace it with their old ones. Remember, every Christian will say to you, honestly, as a Jew, they'd say to you, Rabbi, I want you to know that, you know, my ancestors worshipped toads and cockroaches. Yours worshipped the one God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I just want you to know, for those 1,500 years from Sinai until Jesus, well, your grandparents were right and mine, well, they were wrong. You see what I'm saying? They have embraced our faith, yet the nations of the world have hated us. And if you thought maybe the reason why they couldn't get rid of us is the prophets thought we would be so many in the world, just open up Deuteronomy 4:27. You would be few amongst the nation. All that coming together in the Holy Scriptures. But you got to read it. You can't read one word here and one verse there. You got to take it out. You have to read it. Oh, if you read it, everything changes. What was your second question?
Second question is, as a Holocaust survivor, lived in here in Dallas State for 40 some odd years, I've noticed in the United States, not only in here, but in the United States, that the Holocaust, per se, has become Americanized and Christianized. And I wonder why. What I mean by Americanized and Christianized, everything relating to anything becomes a Holocaust. Anything relating to try to tell the people what the Holocaust is, they would have it in churches instead of synagogues. And I can understand they want to teach the other people on what it was. But it's getting to be so Americanized and so Christianized that I feel there was no more Holocaust anymore. And I'm getting disillusioned.
I understand what you're saying.
I hope you can answer me that.
I hope I can answer that question. It's very difficult. You know, yesterday we were shooting a commercial here in Dallas for the tape series. And some of the people that were with us yesterday, one of them was a woman who had converted to the Jewish faith. And she said, I can't get on camera because I'm going to just start crying. I said, well... She said that I feel so unworthy. You have been through, your people have been through so much, and I'm just hopping on board now. That's how I feel when I go to the Western Wall. My grandfather and grandmother couldn't be there. My great grandparents couldn't be there. My ancestors couldn't be there. Why am I worthy to be there? Just by fluke of God's plan, I was born just a generation or two off from the Holocaust. How am I worthy to be a Jew? It's a very serious question. That is the thought that runs through my mind. I feel when I go into a Holocaust museum, when I see, when I view those burning images, that's what runs through my soul. I feel so unworthy to be a Jew. So I'm unworthy even to stand before you in many ways. And And our sages tell us that Devarim Hayotzim and Alev, Nechnosim and Alev, words that leave the heart, penetrate the heart. And I want you to know also, in that same idea, that we can't build our faith on that Holocaust, or else there'll be another one, in a sense, a spiritual Holocaust. People don't understand the Holocaust and what it means to the Jewish people. No, some have said to me, well, not every person who died in World War II was Jewish. And it's true that not every victim was a Jew, but every Jew was a victim. It's hard to explain. It is very, very difficult. And those who hate us cannot understand the pain, but maybe they do, and that's why they do it, that they rip at our souls when they say the words that they do, those filthy words. So I understand. I really do understand. There's a great dichotomy going on. In one sense, we see the world feeling anguish over what had happened. Yet, and they ask us, why didn't you defend yourself? Why didn't you fight back? There were hundreds of thousands of Jews in Dachau and Auschwitz and so on. Yeah, how many machine guns did they have? I mean, you could have. You should have. We should have been aggressive militarily. You shouldn't have taken it. And here we are, we're standing in 1995. And the world is saying, put down your guns, divide your country in half, give this back and that back, and turn your country basically in what is a driveway. And only we have an imperative for that land, because it is true that the nations that surround the land of Israel have proven that not only can they tolerate a Holocaust, they can participate in one. We have one country, they have 22. We need a secure place for us. They have proven it to us. It's not a question of national pride. We have an imperative. So I hold your hand, and I know, I understand. I just say, let's look to the future, and let's not repeat the mistakes that we've made. Don't say Jesus Christ. It's wrong. Don't say occupied territories. Don't say Old Testament. Don't say West Bank. You're buying into it when you say it. It's Judea and Samaria. Judean desert. That's Jewish. So I understand and I appreciate your question. I hope I've answered it in the way that I have. Yes?
Rabbi, I just wonder, how do you feel saying our Bible?
I have to repeat that. Say that again, I'm sorry.
I just wonder how you feel about our Bible.
Yes.
Can you define the Bible from a Jewish point of view?
Can I define the Bible from a Jewish point of view? Okay. You mean what content are we referring to?
What I'm saying is the Torah does not belong to Jewish people. Any of the prophets and the Jewish people.
You know, so much of our language is not a part of the Jewish people. My gosh, looking at you and your complexion, I have a feeling that your Hebrew is going to be more authentic than mine. Because my answer, I may have gotten that one wrong, I don't know. Or maybe not. But indeed, you know, so much had been corrupted. You know, when you see a Yemenite Jew, sit down and listen to him. Because the Yemenite Jew has an uncorrupted transmission. You know, they've been there for a very long time and they didn't endure what we endured. So we do use the language that people understand. Now, you do use the word Bible, but the word is Tanakh. And
when you say Bible, that means the whole package?
The whole package, what a Muslim considers, or a Christian, or a Jew? No, obviously not. Unless I'm saying to you, this is what a Christian says. I usually will try to use the word Jewish scriptures in New Testament. I try to do that. I try the best of that I can.
I know, when you say my Bible, you mean my Tanakh?
I mean my Tanakh, right.
But what's the difference from your Bible and the Christian Bible?
27 books. You had a question back there?
Yes, I'd like to just put it on the record that Hitler wasn't a Christian, he was a practicing atheist. He looked at the Nietzsche and Darwin, I'm sure you're well aware of that. You know that he did look at Darwin and Nietzsche, but that's one of the...
And Wagner and so on, but I'm not sure what, you know...
That's what I wanted to point out, is he did mention that being Christian.
I think it's important. No, this is a fair statement. I think it's important for you to understand the heart and soul of a Jew. You know, and sometimes it's difficult. You know, if we're not from that people, it's difficult to understand what they're saying.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No. It's very important to understand. If it's important to you, then it's important to listen, you know, to the Jew, so that you understand what he's saying. He's not talking about Hitler being a devout Christian. That's not said. What the Jew is saying, that Hitler could not have succeeded in India. It wouldn't have worked there. It wouldn't have worked in a Hindu or Buddhist country. We've never had a Holocaust. The Buddhists never gave us a Holocaust. It is only Christian Europe that could have provided a Holocaust for Hitler. Okay? So now, it's important for you to understand that in order to appreciate what a Jew feels. And I'm not saying to you that you should believe any of that. I'm not trying to persuade you of that. But if you do want to understand what a Jew feels, that's how we feel. Okay? What's your question?
You mentioned the word economy twice.
The word economy?
Yeah, when you're talking about the prosperity, maybe, of the Jews.
Dichotomy.
It's almost the same. Don't. I'm just kidding. But no, dichotomy means. You know what it is? You chose. Why did you choose? You're all the way back there, Nebuch, so you can't hear. Next time, August 31st, you'll be up front.
Come. A lot of the times when I talk to a Jewish person that, you know, practices in Judaism, they, a lot of the time, they look at the Bible as referring to a Messiah that would change things politically, and I don't really see that happening. I think God deals with people's hearts spiritually, and what I've seen this in 40 years in the wilderness, God gave them a miracle to make the man every day. They wanted something else, they wanted meat, they started getting stuff discovered, and God sent them next to bite them. They wouldn't give up that spirit of that rebellion. And he had, you know, weed them out of them in a way, right? What I'd say is, what he's doing there is changing people's hearts.
What he's doing there, what who's doing where?
God.
Is doing where?
The Jews in the
okay.
Years, okay?
What's your question?
My question is this the way you see it also? Because I think that Moses was God's chosen person. And he struck the rock and he didn't let Moses into the land of the time.
Okay. Okay. First of all, it's important for you to understand. I really thank you for your question. But the Jews aren't looking for a Messiah that would change our political standard. I mean, we're not looking for the Messiah to give us a Republican president. Right? No, seriously, we're not.
Yes.
Although that wouldn't be bad, but no. No. Well, I don't know, how does it work in Dallas? The Jews are Democrats and Republicans. Okay, killed it yet.
A lot of
both there. We're getting a little conservative there. We're on our way. All right. That's not bad. So what I mean is, we are a Bible-based faith. That's very important for you as a Christian to understand. That means that we only care what does the Bible say. If the Bible says jump, then our only question is how high. Good. You're all good. Let's try the next one. Okay. I got you. Wrapped around my finger there. Wait, by next time I can have you. Like, what's his name? We were watching on the Lakewood Church in Houston. What's his name? Come on, you guys. Really? No one watches him? Owens? You don't know? From the Lakewood Church in Houston. He says, say this after me, and they say it, and I'm saying, wow, if I can do that with my audience. I'm right there, that close. I can have you. Okay. It's my turn. We only care what the Bible says. That's all we're interested in. Okay? Therefore, when Scripture says in Ezekiel 37 that I am going to bring you from the lands that you were scattered, and you will have one king over all of you, we take that very seriously. When the prophets tell us that all the world, all kings serve him, we believe.